on this edition for Sunday, July 11th. An uptick in COVID cases as vaccination rates slow. Virgin Galactic's historic launch to space. And one small company's push for child labor-free chocolate. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfein Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities. Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. The Delta variant is leading to surges in coronavirus cases in several states, particularly in places where vaccination rates are lagging. Across the United States, cases are up about 47% on average compared to 2 weeks ago, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. Today, the nation's chief medical advisor said people who are vaccinated do not need to worry about the Delta variant, and that based on current data, there is no need for a vaccine booster shot.
The bad news is that we have a very nasty variant, and the good news is that we have a vaccine that works against it. That's the reason why we're very concerned, is that we have some sort of a schism between some states and some areas that have a very low level of vaccination, which is really unfortunate.
One example of that is in Missouri, where the number of confirmed daily infections is up 83% on average compared to 2 weeks ago, according to CDC data, although daily cases are still well below highs seen last November. Missouri has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, with about 49% of adults fully vaccinated compared to a national average of about 58.7%. In Surfside, Florida, recovery teams continue to make progress in identifying victims at the site of the deadly collapse of the 12-story Champlain Tower South condo building. The death toll now stands at 90, up from 86 yesterday, and 31 people still unaccounted for, according to Miami-Dade County's mayor. Crews continue to work around the clock at the site, carefully removing layers of the debris, identifying remains of victims, and finding personal effects.
The work is still so delicate that we've even found unbroken wine bottles in the rubble and recovered them. We're also finding personal possessions as small as rings.
Members of an Israeli Defense Forces rescue unit were given a ceremonial send-off yesterday after assisting in the search and recovery effort for more than 2 weeks. The team used blueprints to make a 3D rendering of the building, helping identify exactly where victims would have been when this structure collapsed in the pre-dawn hours of June 24th. Results from last month's national election in Ethiopia, released late yesterday, gave Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's Prosperity Party a landslide victory. Ahmed's party won 410 of 436 seats in parliament, assuring him of a second term. Ahmed, who has been in office since 2018, hailed the vote as the country's first fair and free elections after decades of repressive rule. But an opposition boycott and ethnic violence overshadowed the election. Voting did not take place in three of the country's 10 regions, including in conflict-hit Tigray, where fighting between Ethiopian government troops and opposition rebel forces continues. Pope Francis made his first public appearance today after undergoing surgery last week. Francis greeted well-wishers from a balcony at Rome's Gemelli Polyclinic Hospital instead of his traditional Sunday appearance from a window overlooking St. Peter's Square. Officials at the Vatican report the 84-year-old Francis is steadily on the mend after surgery to remove a portion of his large intestine. During his brief remarks, the Pope said he was praying for Haiti after the killing of the country's president. He joined Haiti's bishops in appeals to end the spiral of violence and to find a path toward peace and harmony. The record-breaking heat in western states continues this weekend, bringing some of the highest temperatures ever recorded on Earth. More than 31 million people, mostly in Arizona, Nevada, Utah, and California's Central Valley, face excessive heat warnings or heat advisories today. This is the third heat wave to sweep the region this summer. June was the hottest month on record, which led to nearly 200 deaths, strained electric grids, and depleted reservoirs. Heat domes, in which hot, dry ground traps heat and speeds up rising temperatures, are contributing to these current high temperatures. The National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning for much of the West through tomorrow.
What happens when there's not enough childcare?
It's going to be a moment of reckoning.
Tune in tomorrow for NewsHour's week-long series on the childcare crisis in America. Raising the Future, America's Childcare Dilemma. Billionaire Richard Branson, two pilots, and three other crew members took off for space this morning. Branson's space travel company, Virgin Galactic, uses a specially designed double aircraft to carry its space plane aloft. The space plane then fired a rocket motor to head to the edge of space about 53 miles above Earth and glided back to a safe landing. Today's flight gave Branson a win in what's being called the billionaire space race. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos is set to launch on one of his Blue Origin missions 9 days from now. For more on the space launch, I spoke with Nicholas Schmidl, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, Test Gods, Virgin Galactic and the Making of a Modern Astronaut. So, Nicholas, today's liftoff, launch, I mean, is this essentially just a race between billionaires? I mean, why was it so significant?
This is a real thing. This is not just a contest between, you know, the world's richest men for who can sort of have the biggest toys. Yeah. That part is certainly there, no doubt. And this is a vindication. I think, you know, what's really important to remember is that Richard Branson he's not someone, his business empire is not based on things that he has built with his hands. He's a marketing genius, right? And he has built brands, he has built companies, but he specializes in the customer experience. And that's what he was going to do with Virgin Galactic. He had another company, Scaled Composites, which was going to build the spaceship for him, hand it off. He was going to then sort of brand it up, and then he was going to fly passengers. And then this terrible crash in 2014 tore those plans apart. And suddenly Richard Branson is overseeing a company, his first sort of company that started really building things, and it's building spaceships. And so today was a vindication. Now the next question is whether he'll be able to turn this into a viable business. But, you know, we'll let him have his day of massive success for there.
This success is on the back of a lot of hardship. They've lost people. There's a reason this is called exploration and rocket science.
You know, 2007, there were three engineers that were killed in a propulsion accident out in Mojave, California. In 2014, there was this crash. In 2019, their second space flight, they nearly lost the vehicle. And when they landed, and they wheeled the spaceship into the hangar, you know, the test pilots and the engineers were sort of all looking at each other and asking themselves, like, we very well could have killed two pilots and one engineer, and they didn't. And so, yeah, the costs are real. And Richard Branson's life right there was in the hands of two test pilots.
Speaking of that, you have this very different model. It's not a rocket going straight up and coming back down. This is essentially a plane carrying another plane and then launching off from the sky, right? So why this big structural difference? Doesn't sort of physics favor just the rocket model?
Physics do favor that model. And I think it's important to remember that Bezos and Musk are, you know, computer scientists, they're programmers. There's this ethos at those companies that you can program your way through human error. And Richard Branson has just always been more interested in the romance of it. He didn't actually make the decision to go with this spaceship so much as this spaceship, a smaller version of the spaceship, won the XPRIZE in 2004. Richard Branson said, I love it, build me a bigger one. And so that's kind of, that's the genesis of Spaceship Two and Virgin Galactic's whole configuration, which is that it was, it worked in 2004. And what they've discovered is that it's much harder to scale than they thought.
So this is just really kind of nerds that might be quibbling, but did Branson make it to space as we define it?
The internationally recognized space is 328,000 feet above sea level, which is 100 kilometers, round number, right? The U.S. uses another round number, 50 miles, which comes to 264,000 feet. So Virgin Galactic was designed to go to 328. Unfortunately, every accident makes you build a ship a little bit heavier. And a heavier spaceship is inherently a harder spaceship to get out of the atmosphere. When they realized they couldn't get to 328, they said, we're going to go for 50 miles for now.
Yeah.
Look, I've seen the video, you know, you can see the cockpit video. Stuff's floating. It's black. It's a blue earth down below. Like, it looks like space to me, yeah. but it does, you know, there, you know, the Virgin Galactic's president said to me in 2019, he conceded that it does give Blue Origin a leg to stand on, that yeah. they are going to the international boundary of space. So, you know, I think Virgin Galactic will get there eventually, but I think it'll take them a while to get there.
Nicholas Schmidl, author of the book Test Gods, Virgin Galactic, and the Making of a Modern Astronaut. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
Nearly two-thirds of the world's cocoa production comes from West Africa, where an estimated 1.6 million children work illegally on farms across the region. But rooting out the illegal practice is difficult. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of food giants Nestle and Cargill, where both companies were being sued over claims that they knowingly bought cocoa beans from farms which used child slave labor. But one small company in the Netherlands is on a mission to shake up the industry and eliminate illegal child labor completely. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Megan Thompson reports.
There's something striking about the Amsterdam offices of chocolate company Tony's Chocolonely. The tables and bikes outside. The floors, envelopes, and shipping boxes inside.
Red balloons.
Virtually everything is fire engine red. It's partly the playful nature of the growing company where employees all have fanciful titles like Impactus Prime, Inspire to Actress, and the boss.
So I hate to be called CEO. I just want to be the chief chocolate officer.
But the color also serves a serious purpose.
The real color of alarm is red. And if you really want to point out that there is a problem and that something has to be done, you have to use the color of red. These are the kids.
The problem, children working illegally in the supply chain of cocoa.
And if you realize kids are actually producing the chocolate that we love, then you have the feeling something needs to change.
Tony's has a goal to make chocolate what they call 100% slave-free. Not just their chocolate, all chocolate.
Our goal is to eradicate all illegal labor from the value chain of cocoa.
That is quite an ambitious mission for a small company that we are, but we are very serious about it.
And it is a serious problem. According to a recent report, in the cocoa growing areas of Ghana and Ivory Coast, where most of the beans used to make the world's chocolate come from, almost half of the children work as child laborers. That's more than 1.5 million children. Most are doing what's termed hazardous work involving sharp tools, heavy loads, or toxic pesticides. It's all part of the laborious process of separating beans from the large cocoa pods pulled from trees.
If the child is working on a weekend, for example, helping the parents, that's not child labor, that's child work. But if they're missing school, or if they're doing work that is detrimental to their health, that is child labor.
Ngoi Nyong'o is the global CEO of Fairtrade International, which certifies ethical practices of products around the world. Cocoa is its flagship issue. Nyong'o says the price is basically controlled by a handful of large chocolate conglomerates who pay farmers very little. Families who can't afford to hire workers are using their children instead.
It's about not earning a living income. It's about farmers struggling, but not getting the returns that they should get from the products that they grow.
The worst forms of child labor, when children are trafficked and forced to work without pay. That's what police in Ivory Coast were after in this raid on a cocoa farm last year. According to one study, as many as 16,000 children in West Africa are being exploited this way. Although child labor is not unique to cocoa, the fact that chocolate is a luxury product, a more than $100 billion a year business when most cocoa farmers live below the poverty line, is what struck Dutch journalist Teun van de Koken as particularly outrageous. He was even filmed for a television program trying to get himself prosecuted, arguing that by eating chocolate, he was complicit in a crime. In 2005, he co-founded Tony's Chocolonely, a combination of his first name and what he called the lonely battle to reform the chocolate industry.
But on the inside,
the messaging includes the uneven way the bars are divided.
Sometimes you have a big piece, like the big chocolate companies, and sometimes you only get a very small piece, just like the cocoa farmers get so little of the value of chocolate.
While Tony's isn't the only chocolate company touting its ethical practices, it's arguably one of the most successful. What started off in a whimsical way with just 5,000 chocolate bars is now the most popular chocolate brand in the Netherlands, with about $100 million in revenue last year. And the company is expanding into markets around the world, including the United States. Key to Tony's strategy is traceability. Cocoa beans in West Africa come from thousands of small farms and pass through many hands. Most big chocolate companies admit they don't know where all their beans come from. Tony's, on the other hand, has long-term relationships with specific cooperatives.
My Tony's title is Lean the Supply Chain Machine.
And it's even developed its own online software to track every bag of beans by lot number.
And we can trace back which farmers have supplied the beans into that one lot number. It gives us visibility on traceability, basically.
And Tony's pays premiums to help farmers modernize and get out of poverty. In Ivory Coast, for example, Tony's is now paying about 68% more than the minimum price set by the government. And that contributes to making the chocolate more expensive.
In the U.S., this bar is a little under $5, this bar would have costed, let's say, $3.50 if we were paying the lowest possible price to farmers. But we don't pay the lowest possible price to farmers. We pay a dignified price that brings them to living income.
This problem is not exactly new. The chocolate industry has been under fire for years. Back in 2001, after the U.S. Congress threatened legislation to address child labor in cocoa, eight of the biggest chocolate companies negotiated a voluntary agreement instead, pledging to eradicate the worst forms of child labor in cocoa by 2005. That deadline and others in 2008, 2010, and 2020 came and went. Now they say they're committed to a new deadline, 2025.
And if you look at some of the big chocolate company websites like Mars, Nestle, or Hershey, the issue is front and center. They talk about protecting children with big investments in local communities, working with families to get kids back into school, and increasing child labor monitoring programs. But still, the number of child laborers in West Africa hasn't changed much over the years. And as of today, only about 25% of the supply chain is even being monitored for child labor.
The aim is to increase those programs.
Alexander Ferguson is with the World Cocoa Foundation, a trade group that represents about 80% of the chocolate industry.
A lot of the big chocolate companies have programs to crack down on child labor. Are those programs going far enough?
I think the mistake made in the past is that companies thought they could solve this alone. Many of our companies do have supply lines that are traceable and look for child labor and also pay premiums to farmers so that they get a higher income. This is something that is being done across the industry. And there needs to be more of it.
So some companies could be doing very well. Some companies are not doing anything because all this is voluntary. And for years, for over 20 years, we've had a lot of these voluntary initiatives that have really made little difference, I must say. And I think when it becomes compulsory that companies have to be responsible for what happens in their supply chain, I think that's where we'll really make an impact.
Tony's agrees laws are needed. Its most recent lobbying effort, a petition to the EU signed by more than 66,000 of its Choco fans, supporting a law that would hold all companies accountable for their supply chains.
We have to look for problems in the supply chain in order to solve them. So it's about pulling the problems towards us instead of pushing them away.
And Tony's does find problems, cases of child labor among its farmer cooperatives. When it does, says Impact Navigator Pavithra Ram, local monitors track everyone and work to get children out of danger or into school.
Other chocolate companies also use some sort of the child labor monitoring system. What makes us unique is that we implement it for 100% of our supply chain. So you can't just go to some communities or a part of your supply chain and say, oh, we're monitoring there, we found cases. You need to do it for your entire supply chain, because otherwise you're not doing enough.
Tony's efforts have won over at least one major ally, Barry Callebaut, the biggest chocolate manufacturer in the world.
I think Tony's is really a pioneer and also a leader and a front runner.
Barry Callebaut produces chocolate for brands around the world, turning beans into liquid, a key part of the chocolate making process. Tony's convinced the company to use separate tanks to segregate its beans to preserve the integrity of its supply chain. And that was a hard sell at first.
It was not easy. Investments had to be done. Cost of production would not be as efficient. But some of us believed in it, and we convinced the board to do the investments. And I'm very happy we did.
Tony's Chocolate Only believes in sharing.
Now Tony's is working with Barry Callebaut to get other brands to adopt its core principles, like giving farmers more support and pay, and offering to share its network of farmer cooperatives and bean tracker software in a program it calls Tony's Open Chain.
The goal is to really make it easy for chocolate brands to plug into a proven and working cocoa flow.
So far, three competitors have joined, including Aldi, and the largest supermarket chain in the Netherlands with its Delicata chocolate brand. But can Tony's really make a difference? Critics point out the company is still relatively small, working with only about 0.5% of the some 1.6 million cocoa farmers in West Africa. And one watchdog group has removed Tony's from its slave-free chocolate list because its production partner, Barry Callebaut, can't guarantee that all of the beans from its many other customers are 100% traceable.
So the team is growing and growing.
But Tony's CCO, Beltman, is unapologetic. He says the partnership with the chocolate giant is part of a dual strategy: to lead by example and reform from within.
If you want to make impact at scale, you have to work with the player that is producing at scale. And sometimes we have a feeling that the task that we are taking on our shoulders is rather big. But with a little bit of naivety and arrogance, we can do a lot.
And they are becoming really a big brand. And if you see how small brands are becoming disruptive, that's a bit the name of the game. What started a bit as a joke with an important message is now a big company. And potentially Tony's will be bigger than Barry Callebaut 5 years from now. You never know what happens in this disruptive world.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Finally tonight, Cyprus is known as the Island of Cats. Legend has it that someone, maybe Cleopatra, maybe St. Helena, the mother of Constantine the Great, shipped cats to the island nation to help exterminate snakes. However they got there, the number of cats is now almost equaling the number of humans, and cat lovers are springing into action.
Every day, cats emerge from the shadows as volunteers arrive with food at this cemetery. As the food plates are filled, stray cats gather and choose their places, sometimes on the food truck itself.
There has been no official count, but based on our own assessment, we could say that the number of stray cats are equal to the human population of the island at the very least. They could be approaching 1 million. That's a rough estimate.
Cats have been here for thousands of years, but despite their fame, their numbers are starting to wear on some Cypriots.
If there is no serious intervention to control the population, we will have a big problem. It is already a big problem. There are neighborhoods where some feed them, others might not want them. They throw down poison. Arguments break out among the neighbors. This is not right. There are ways to deal with this.
In April, the government authorized close to $90,000 for sterilization programs. But at this sanctuary, not far from a monastery named St. Nicholas of the Cats, kittens and cats arrive almost daily.
The challenge is the number of cats that are out in the population. There is a limit to what we could do to help those cats.
Animal rescue groups say they're hoping for more resources, but for now, it's the kindness of volunteers that's keeping at least some Cypriot cats happy and healthy.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities. Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.